to what seems to me to be the essential point about teaching, about education, that a teacher must know and hold on to, whatever else goes. And thinking over that, it seemed to me that the first thing I wanted to say is just that teaching is one of the forms of personal relationship. That the relation between a teacher and his pupils, those who learn from him, is one of the typical human relations, one which is a fundamental one. Teaching is not, and never can be, in the nature of things, however much you try to make it. So, it can never be a business, an industry, which you can learn the techniques and be successful. You can't be successful as a teacher in any other way than the ways in which you can be successful as a friend, as a husband or wife, and to say in any of the more intimate personal relationships, because the relation between a teacher and his pupils, especially in the early stages of their education, is and ought to be, and must be if it's to be successful, an intimate relation, a relation in which two human beings meet and like one another, care for one another, and help one another. That's the secret of it. And the rest of what I would like to say will be kind of comment on this. And I would begin by contrasting two attitudes which we can take up to one another. There is one which is an entering into personal relation. And I just put it like that, I think you know what I mean. It's the kind of relation that human beings who have nothing against one another naturally enter into. And we share our experience, because that's an extraordinarily important thing in the nature of human life. It's essentially shared. We live by what other people have said and thought and done. And most of our education is making our own what has happened to other people and what they have thought and said. By that personal relationship, I mean no more than what, and its finest blossoming, is a friendship between two people. And its characteristic, it might be worth remembering, its characteristics are freedom and equality. Any personal relationship depends entirely on these two. If it hasn't got equality as it's one of its structural principles, then it has to be a relation between a master and a servant. If it hasn't got freedom, then it is restricted and limited. The more, the less freedom there is in it, the less personal it gets. And the more it too tends to become a relationship in which one party is trying to use the other party for his own purposes. Now contrast that with another kind of relationship that you meet with sometimes, not I hope very often. But I'm sure you know, as I do, what it's like to be treated by another person as some curious kind of object that they are examining. And you know the kind of effect that has on you, especially when it's somebody who is in a position of authority, and who looks at you as if you weren't quite human, and asks questions that show that that's more or less what he thinks of you. Who refuses, that is to say, the first thing that we demand from one another, and have a right to demand, the sense that we are just as human as he is, and that in terms of that common humanity, he has no right whatever to treat us as if we weren't, as if we were merely objects in a world which is more or less interesting for him to observe and dock it in his mind as this kind or that kind of curious type. The word that is used for that attitude of mind customarily nowadays is the word objectivity. To treat another person with objectivity is to treat them as a case or a type or something that is an object which you don't enter into relations with, but you observe, and if the necessity arises, manipulate by your knowledge of how to make other people do what you want them to do. That is, if you like, the scientific attitude. An attitude which in its own place is perfectly legitimate. And even in our relations with one another, there are instances, there are situations in which it is the proper attitude up to a point. But always falling within something that is wider, something that is inherently and essentially human. And in our own field as teachers, it has its place, but always as governed and controlled by the more fundamental, the more natural, the more human attitude, which is interpersonal relation, a relation in which we are both aware that we are both human beings, and one of us is not subject while the other is object, in which we are both subjects, to use the technical philosophical language, and in which we communicate or share our human experience. The modern attempt, for which I have done a good deal to encourage, to produce sciences of human behavior in psychological, sociological, and so on, are at the moment, in defect of this understanding, full of the attempt to be objective, with the results which you might expect. Let me give you one example which I found interesting and somewhat comic when I first met it. It was when I was lecturing at the University of Yale in America, where they had at the time a young man who was making a great splash and noise in the American world as a lawyer with a very strongly sociological bent. And he wanted to use the American legal system as a sociological instrument for doing something which he thought should be done to the American people. And he'd written a book about it. And he was, I was told about him and told what an up-and-coming young man he was, how important the work he was doing was going to be. And I said I was interested, and the professor who was talking to me said, look, I'll just get you his book and you can sit down in the sun and read it while I do something else. And so he brought it to me and I opened it and started to read the introduction. It was quite interesting introduction, very amusing indeed. He started by saying something about the development of science. Science had developed in physics and then in biology, and now we were wrestling to establish it in the field of human behavior, in sociology particularly, which he was interested in. And he said the great obstacle to the development of science has always been anthropomorphism, he called it. And he told the story of how anthropomorphism had ruled in human ideas about the nature of the world, and science, scientific physics and chemistry only got going when you got rid of anthropomorphism. And similarly, when it came to the turn of the biological sciences to be established, there was the same struggle to get rid of anthropomorphism, and only when we got rid of that did we establish a really scientific biology. And now it was the turn of the establishment of the social sciences. And we were then in the same fix. We were still full of anthropomorphic ideas. And until we got rid of anthropomorphic ideas in the social sciences, we could never develop them at all. They would remain, as they were, just a mess. And the poor fellow never understood what he was saying. As you can see, he was merely saying, we'll never understand human beings unless we learn to treat them as if they weren't human beings. Very curious statement. And yet, I've read a good many books about psychology and sociology since that day, and there's an awful lot of that in them. This curious notion that you never know anything about human beings unless you treat them as if they were objects and not human beings at all. Now the truth is, as I was trying to say, and which I think is the essential thing that one must keep hold of in education, you'll never know anything about a human being unless you enter into human relations with him. And it doesn't matter how old he is, the thing starts from birth. Human beings are persons, and they're born persons. They're not animals. The gulf between the human field and the animal field is as wide, if not wider, than that between the field of living things and material objects. And the essential point in saying that is that in order to know or to understand in this field, you must use the means that are appropriate to it. The real trouble that underlies these absurdities that do crop up in the scientific study of human behavior arise simply because people are trying to use the wrong tools. They've got an idea that the kind of way you get on, say in physics and chemistry so well, or attend it in biology, is the way you've got to use when you turn to the study of human beings. And it is just stupid. It's a failure to realize, a failure to be empirical, a failure to realize the kind of thing you're dealing with and the ways in which it can be successfully dealt with. So may I then enlarge on this in another way? Say something first about this child and then a little about the teacher. There is an idea, it's widespread, it's, so far as I can see, almost purely dogmatic or traditional. The children are born into the world with a stock of instincts, if you would like to call them so, or established ways of behavior, or tendencies to behavior, which they share with the animals, and that this is the kind of material that is educated into human maturity. It was Aristotle's philosophy that was the source of this curious notion. I think that there is absolutely no ground for it at all. I should say quite point blank that we are born without any instincts whatever, that there are no such things as instincts in human behavior, and you've only got to define an instinct carefully in the biological sense to see that. And on the other hand, he is not born into a natural environment. We're born without instincts. That is to say, completely helpless, There's nothing that we can do towards our own survival. And we're born into an unnatural environment, I mean talking in the biological sense, into a human environment. We're surrounded by things that are the embodiments of human purpose, not by nature. Nature is way out there, it's distance. We don't meet it till much later, after we've been educated quite a lot. We're surrounded by chairs and tables and fire and all the kind of things that human beings make for themselves to enable them to live a human life. That's what we meet with and what we learn about first. Nature, if it ever comes in at all, which I doubt, in the biologist's sense, is a long way away. It's qualified. It's qualified by this human environment through which we see it. And in the long run, we sometimes find that even grown-up people haven't managed to get rid of the anthropomorphism that hangs about nature. Because it's quite an achievement to get rid of anthropomorphism, even where it has to be got rid of. And what a child has by way of adaptation to the environment into which he is born is simply that he is born to be taken care of and has naturally those fundamental capacities which enable him to fulfill his role. He's not born to do anything. He's born in to a situation in which everything has to be done for him and to which he contributes at first nothing. The only thing therefore that he needs is some way of indicating to those who do take care of him that he needs to be taken care of. And if he's got a pain in his tummy, he yells, and his mother knows that means something's got to be done for him. In other words, what eventually we mean by saying that thing that distinguishes us from the animals is language, it's a misstatement as it stands, but this is what it really means. That the fundamental adaptation of human beings to life, the one that they are born with, and which develops as fundamental in human life throughout, and what underlies the whole process of education and its necessity is this capacity to communicate. I said that language is not enough to say that language is what makes us human. We are human before we can speak. But language happens to be the most highly developed mode which human beings have invented to get into communication with one another much more fully than they can when they're just babies. The drive, shall we say, to communicate, that is to say, to enter into a relation with other people and out of that to create personal cooperation in living. That is the primary thing with which we are born. Everything else, and also the means, the developing means of entering into a fuller and richer communication with the human world around us, comes, everything else has to be learnt. That's what makes, as the great thinkers have always seen from the time of the Greeks onwards in our own civilization, that is what makes education the central thing in human life. Plato, you may remember, in the Republic, when he made Socrates answer the question, well, what about government in this state that we are trying to build up. His answer was that if we will attend properly to the education of the children, everything else will be perfectly easy. And if you want government, just get in a dozen citizens who happen to be passing in the street, put the problem to them, and they'll solve it. I'm not saying that you could do that in a modern state. That's another matter. Maybe worse for the modern state that it isn't so. Education, in the full sense, is then the development of this primary human capacity and need for entering into communication with others. Because we live by that. It is by the handing on from generation to generation of the techniques of living that have been developed by our ancestors and which are in force all around us. It's by learning these that we become able to take our part in the human community. And the other thing then I might say, because I can't enlarge on this, is that you might say the whole process of growing up is a process which hinges upon the kind of dependence that each human individual shares, dependence upon other people. It goes from the starting point in an utter dependence in which we can do nothing for ourselves, in which our survival depends upon other people thinking for us and planning for us and caring for us in every way, to point of maturity in which, if our education has been successful, as it never is completely, we find ourselves members of an interdependence of equals. The one thing that is never true about a human being is that he is independent. The very nature of human life is such that we live by our dependence upon other people. And the older we grow, the more that dependence grows. But it becomes an interdependence in which we can provide our share, an equal share, by way of giving to what we have to take from others. The one thing that doesn't happen, obviously, is that like animals, we need a little help at the beginning, but soon learn to fend for ourselves. Well, we just can't fend for ourselves. We never do. And I sometimes think of the little girl who put it so neatly when she was left to look after a gentleman who had come to see her father. He was put in the room where she was, and she felt she must start a conversation. So she said to him, "Mr. Robinson, my father says that you are a self-made man. Is that true?" And he said, "Yes, my girl, and I'm very proud of it." "Well," she said, "if you made yourself, why did you make yourself like that?" So that, again, I'm not forgetting all the ordinary things that we mean by education, the things we have to learn and be taught. But I'm saying that all this is subordinate to that side of education in which we are, as I put it in a paper I think some of you have read, which I called Learning to be Human. That is to say, the development of the original relationship, human relationship, into which we are born, the relationship with our mother and other people who look after us when we are quite young, the development of that into a relationship of human interdependence through all its successive stages. That is the important thing. The thing within which all other aspects of our education must fall if it's to be satisfactory. And now just a word about the teacher in this. I'm thinking now of the stage at which you are particularly concerned, the stage at which the youngster leaves home for a school of some kind. And there he finds himself face to face with the teacher and all the other little boys and girls who have come in the same way to the school. And I want to talk about, again, the same side of this process of education as I've been talking about so far, which is the thing that's often forgotten. We learn all sorts of techniques of teaching, and I have no objection to a good many of them. We have to learn how best, we have to teach whatever we're teaching, whatever subject we're teaching. Though, don't forget ever, the distinction between subjects is very largely simply for convenience. It could be done in other ways. We do it as a convenient way of manipulating using or dealing with the vast mass of material that every human being has to learn nowadays if he's going to be a member of a modern society. It gets greater and greater. And I think very often we put far too much into it. And in the process of being terribly busy about all this, we forget the fundamental thing. How can I put that? But the teacher stands in loco parentis, takes the place of father or mother in the educational process, and his success or failure depends upon the way he maintains that role. He's there, she's there to care for the children. And unless one does really care for the children, indeed, unless one loves children, one makes a bad teacher. One's heart is not in one's job, and one cannot sustain the role which is fundamental. You all know, I'm sure, how easy it is to make children stupid so that they can't learn. There are teachers who are bad teachers for the simple reason that their personal impact upon the children is to make them take refuge in stupidity and refuse to learn. It is far more common than one's apt to admit, as one naturally, as a teacher, wants to find a scapegoat. Another kind of reason why the children aren't getting on. This matter of caring for the child, establishing trust and friendship, so that he doesn't tell lies to you, he tells you the truth or comes to you with his troubles, and finds himself welcomed and finds himself sharing, as he did at home, his parents, somebody who is older and knows more than he does, sharing his childish troubles and sympathetic and helpful, and which is what he looks for, naturally. That is the first job of creating the condition of doing a good job as a teacher. If that's not done, the rest will be bungled. And it has its other side, because one of the things that makes the school so different from the earlier stage of education is that you get a lot of children all together. Now, this is a very fine thing in the educational process if it's properly managed. That is to say, if you can make the class of the school a community, a real community, in which the children really enter into relationships with one another as if they were now in a much bigger family. But again, it's the same problem, the problem of personal relations. And the secret of this lies in the relations in the school between the teachers themselves. I remember in a school in which I've been the chairman of the governors, a mixed boarding school in England, since it was founded in the early days of the last war. I remember an occasion on which we were having some extra building done. I had been using an old mansion house in which the garages, which are very extensive, had been turned into scientific laboratories, and we were building some flats on top of them. And the workmen were very interested in the work going on and teaching science underneath. And one of them one day said to one of the senior teachers, "I can't believe it." And he said, "What can't you believe?" Well, he said, the teacher came to these boys there, the boys of 12 to 14, into the scientific laboratory, and he gave them a job to do, told them what it was, and he went off and left them, and he didn't come back for half an hour. And you would never have known that he wasn't there. And he thought it was totally unnatural. Evidently, if the teacher went away, the children would take a good chance to vent their own natural feelings and forget all about what they were doing. But they didn't. And if you ask what was the reason why this was characteristic in the school, that there was no problem of general problem of discipline, the answer was that the school had set itself from the very beginning to deal with the personal relations of its staff, never mind the children. And we did manage, to a considerable degree, to produce in that school an extreme friendliness and personal feeling between all members of the staff. Partly because in the early days, when the school was struggling to establish itself, they all shared alike in what money there was available. They had sometimes to do with very little, and the headmaster was paid exactly the same as anybody else. That was his equal share of all the money that was available. It was a wonderful experience, that early days of that school. And I still remember the day on which we decided we must break with this. We had somebody who had been there from the beginning, served the school extremely well, and we felt this ought to be recognized and they should be paid more than the other people. And we worked out some kind of principle on which this was done and offered the lady an extra salary. She turned it down flat. Refused to have a penny more than anybody else. Well, if you get that kind of relationship established in school between the members of the staff, you'll find the problem of discipline amongst the children is solved with it. You have produced the kind of atmosphere, the kind of atmosphere of humanity, of human relations, of people who recognize one another as people and care for one another as people. When you get that, well, it is such a wonderful experience, and the children respond to it by, as they do so easily, by imitation, and their relations to one another become the same kind. I don't mean to say they become softies or anything of that sort. You get your problems all right, but they're real ones, and they are incidents which arise and have their cause and can be dealt with. And may I just finish, because I want to leave a chance for you to talk yourselves and ask questions. I'll just say this, that once, as teachers, we have mastered this, once we do remember that we are dealing all the time, what we're doing is trying to make mature human beings out of younger human beings who are still immature, and it is our task to care for them in that way. Once I've established and kept in mind this element of personal community which underlies the process of education and produces the atmosphere in which real education becomes possible. Once you've mastered this, then you can go back to your sociologists and psychologists and learn a very great deal from them. Because you no longer take them for gospel as the whole story about the human situation, when it's only one aspect of it, and not, from the teacher's point of view, the really fundamental one. Well, now, I'm not going to say any more, because that does make a break, and I should very much like you either to ask questions or to say something about it before we finish.